All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m., and it's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, get your requests in. One artist, three songs. Triple Play Thursday, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. A little pop-up video a little later on. I'll tell you what's coming up for the month of December on Netflix and other streaming devices. And we are going to talk about brand loyalty. All of that and more right here on WGN. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and Facebook.com/Nick D Show is the best way to stay connected. It is time for our biweekly visit from Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan to the show. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you much, Nick.
How was your holiday?
It was quite nice. How was yours?
It was good. It was good. And I had a bunch of days off here from the station, so just did a lot of staycation.
Sounds good, man.
It was good. So welcome back. Let's talk a little bit about obviously there's a lot of TV to talk about. I'd like to first ask you, have you watched season two of Lady Dynamite?
I have watched season two of Lady Dynamite. I watched it last week, and my goodness, that's a great season of TV.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I love Maria Bamford. Tell everybody about the show in case they don't know about it. It's two seasons strong now, so.
Two seasons strong now, and the second season kind of took what was weird and strange and kind of cosmically absurd about the first season and kind of doubled down on it.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, the premise of the show is basically it's kind of semi, but not especially autobiographical, about Maria Bamford and her struggles with mental illness and her childhood in Duluth, Minnesota, and her Los Angeles time. But then the second season adds in a future timeline in which she makes a Lady Dynamite-esque TV show for a Netflix-esque streaming service and deals with futuristic technology a couple of years into the future. The show is it's creative to a level that only a few other shows on TV can match, and the second season was really impressive.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I you know, I loved the first season. I'm a huge Maria Bamford fan. I've loved her forever. And and I didn't think that it could get crazier, because the first season's pretty out there. But pretty early on into the season, the second season, I was like, wow, they're really just going for it here. This is just completely out there, and I love it. And I can't explain how much I love Anna Gasteyer on the show. She's so spectacular. I know it's not going to happen, but first season and second season, even more in the second season, I think she deserves an Emmy nomination for it. She's just phenomenally funny in it.
It is like every performance on the show, it is a show that is a performance that is aggressively out there and pushes to about any imaginable extreme it can go. And it's impressive watching her do it. But all of the supporting performances go the same strange places, whether it's Anna Gasteyer or the two talking pug dogs or the various cameos and guest appearances, whether it's Fred Malamed, you know, just everyone on that show is very committed to this thing that probably when they go home and try to explain it to their friends and loved ones what they did during the day, they have a difficult time explaining. The second season, I thought, was just really impressive. I thought the first season was also very good, but the second season really said, this is a show that no one is putting restrictions on us for, which is funny because part of the gimmick of the show this season is the limitations or directions that the Netflix-esque service is trying to push the show. But very clearly the actual Netflix service is not telling Maria Bamford she can't do anything, which is nice.
That's really great. It is great. And like you said, the cast members and crew members who go home at night and try to explain what's going on. I've tried to explain to people who don't know what Lady Dynamite is, and I can't. I can't really, you know, I mean, especially to people who might not know who Maria Bamford is, you know, because if you have that starting point of Maria Bamford and you know her work and like her background, you can kind of at least get some footing on how to describe the show. But for people who don't know who Maria Bamford is, it's just, first of all, it's too bad that you don't know who Maria Bamford is. I feel bad for you that you don't know who she is. But it's a hard show to sell.
It's very difficult to explain. And it is, as you say, it's hard to describe Maria Bamford's style to anyone and to kind of give anyone the impression of, if you don't know her, she's the kind of person you'll like. I don't know. Like, there's an extended scene in which she and David Spade go back and forth on kind of a deadpan sarcasm off, you know, standoff in a supermarket. And that may be, like, I was sitting there watching that scene and I was thinking, okay, is this sort of a way in which people would understand what the tone of Maria Bamford's comedy is? Like, could you compare it to something like this? Well, no, it's not really like David Spade in terms of its sarcasm, but for this brief scene it was. No, it's a hard to describe show. The second season is even harder to describe, but if you like shows that go for it,
yeah,
this is one that goes for it.
It's great. It's just great. Now, that segues into something that you did for IndieWire as a contribution. They talked about the best TV shows that handle mental health issues well. Talk about
Yeah, that was one of the ones that I definitely mentioned. And it really is. It's a show that gets you into the mindset, basically. It visualizes what it's like to sometimes be in a slide, in a personal slip into losing control, and how you can sometimes pull yourself out, so how sometimes medication helps, how sometimes therapy helps, how sometimes family helps, and how sometimes there's nothing necessarily you can do. And it's complicated in that respect. And it's a lot like Netflix's BoJack Horseman, which I also mentioned in that same poll. And just a great show that finds a way to visualize something that a lot of people can't even find a way to express what it means to them and how they're handling it, you know, in therapy to their loved ones. Some people can't put together the words, and here are these shows that are finding ways to not just put together the words, but to put together the imagery that captures what this is like. Mm-hmm. And it's great that there are shows like this out there. And so there were those two that I put down,
I was very, very happy to see that you mentioned Enlightened, because you know how I feel about that show. So I was very happy to see that you mentioned that, and I agree with you about that. I mean, Enlightened was really about, I mean, the first episode is about a woman who has a complete breakdown, you know, and then how she deals with afterwards is really, really interesting and flawed and crazy, and I love that show so much.
And how all of the people around her are, for the most part, dealing with similar things, maybe not to the exact same full breakdown degree that she's dealing with it, but the Mike White character, later on the Molly Shannon character. There are many different characters on Enlightened who are going through their own breakdowns of various different kinds. I think one of the things Enlightened probably does best is showing the rainbow of colors of just trouble that sometimes people have going through ordinary life, and that it doesn't need to be this huge dramatic thing like Laura Dern's character has. It can be all manner of little, medium, large, and that's, I think it's important.
I think so too. I mean, I remember the episode where you know, Luke Wilson plays her ex-husband in it, and she tells him that they want to go, they're going to go away on a canoe trip. And that episode, I remember that episode just destroying me. He's an alcoholic and he takes drugs and he's got multiple issues, and this canoe trip, or this, you know, is supposed to reconcile things between them, and she throws her drugs out. And I just remember that episode being about two really screwed up people. I was affected by every episode of that show, but that one in particular really destroyed me.
There was that episode. There was, of course, and I'm still a little bit annoyed that Diane Ladd didn't win an Emmy for it, the Consider Helen episode focused on the main character's mother, and with Diane Ladd playing that character, just one of the great limited supporting roles. You know, this was not a character who was huge in every episode, but any time the show gave that character a chance to shine, Diane Ladd was spectacular in it. Yeah. So, yeah, that was one. What else did I list? I went a little bit old and a little bit foreign, and I went with the classic BBC, The Singing Detective.
Oh, which, yeah.
which is just another one of those magnificent visualizations of what it means to just gradually lose it step by step by step. And I can't think of many shows that actually drag you down to quite that degree and put you in that headspace to that degree.
Yeah.
So that would be another. There really are a lot of shows right now that are trying to tackle all manner of mental illness, and I think it's a great thing television's doing. One of the many things about there being an endless, bottomless reservoir of television is that they can tackle many subjects well, and mental illness happens to be one that is being tackled very well by a number of shows now.
Yeah, it's true. All right, Dan, hang out, okay?
Of course.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us. He is the TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Lots of TV to talk about. We've got to take a break for the news right now, and we'll come back with more TV after the news. Welcome back. How you doing, everybody? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk, text, and triple play Thursday requests. One artist, three songs. Get them in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about brand loyalty. We're going to tell you what's coming up on Netflix for the month of December. And we'll play another edition. Skip Skipley's on his way. And another edition of Pop-Up Video is coming up. Right now, though, it's our biweekly visit with Dan Feinberg, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you much.
All right. Want to talk about your Critics Notebook, Strong Year for TV Actresses. And it's going to be a stiff competition for the Golden Globes and the SAG Awards. We are in award season, and I have proof of that because I have about 50 screeners on my coffee table at home. So I know award season is happening. So let's talk.
And some of it, I assume, is good, and that's good. And I also, let's be honest, some of it you can just skip.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I've got stacks, literally two giant stacks of movie screeners on my coffee table at home. Some of which I've watched and enjoyed. And some of which I know I won't have to. And I just, like yesterday, I watched Call Me By Your Name. Have you seen that yet, Dan?
I have, and quite enjoyed it. That should be a contender for awards.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. No question about it. And the Italy Tourism Board should cut a giant check to that production, because 15 minutes in, you're like, I want to move there. I want to move there now. But it's an extraordinary movie. And you know, we were talking about in Fargo, Michael Stahlberg is in Fargo. What a year this guy's having, you know, including that in The Shape of Water. And he's got a monologue in Call Me By Your Name that is just jaw-droppingly beautiful. He's had a great year. But let's talk about the women who have had a great year on TV.
Yeah, basically I was sort of asked to approach the award season in a sort of general way, and the easiest way for me to approach it was, my goodness, I'm interested to see what actresses get nominated for things, and I don't really know that I care all that much about what actors get nominated for anything. So I believe the concluding line of that piece was, men will also be nominated for acting awards by the Golden Globes.
Well, let's bat this around. Let's bat this around a little bit. You know, we've been talking about this, covering it throughout the year, how strong the female roles have been, and let's talk a little about some of the contenders for this year.
Well, of course, there are such conversational favorites of ours, such as Handmaid's Tale. Yep. I believe that it's a pretty sure thing that both SAG voters and Golden Globe voters will have no choice but to recognize Elizabeth Moss. But that's also one of those shows that's practically made for the Screen Actors Guild Ensemble Award, because, you know, that's a cast where there could be 10 actresses nominated, and instead there will maybe be a couple. I think that for Golden Globes purposes, I'm not really sure who else is going to get nominated. Whereas for SAG, I feel like Ann Dowd is the kind of veteran character actor. Not that she likes to be called character actor. She likes to just be called an actor, and that's
right.
Fine.
Right.
But she's the kind of actor that the SAG voters would tend to like. So I assume that they will. But then you start getting into all of the people who are going to be up for multiple things. So Elizabeth Moss has that, but then she also has Top of the Lake, and she will probably be nominated a couple places for that as well, I assume. And so, of course, that one also co-stars Nicole Kidman, who will be up potentially for awards there, but certainly will be up for awards for Big Little Lies. Yeah. One of the things I did in this article is one of the paragraphs is basically making a big circle of everybody who will either be competing against themselves or competing against people from their shows. So Nicole Kidman will then be going against her co-star Reese Witherspoon from Big Little Lies, and Big Little Lies could also put Laura Dern into acting fields, but Laura Dern is also going to be a contender for Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. And so it's all just very circular, and it's going to be interesting to see how many of the great performances people can nominate for awards and then also sadly forget to nominate Carrie Coon for The Leftovers, because that just makes me sad because she should be nominated for all of the awards for Leftovers, and there are only a few more awards where I'll even be able to say that, because then it just won't be in the year anymore, and no one will be robbing her of nominations anymore because it'll be too long, and then that'll be genuinely sad. So,
and what you got Feud as well with the two female leads there.
Indeed. So I assume that once again, all of the various movie actress categories will be the two Big Little Lies actresses against the two Feud actresses. And probably I suspect that Nicole Kidman's just going to keep winning everything. But I imagine everyone will be able to find nominations for everyone unless Susan Sarandon keeps giving interviews to foreign publications. Talking about politics.
Right. I know. I got you. And you do mention Glow, which I would love to see that get a little ensemble love.
I think that when you look at it in terms of new comedies, that's one that's out there. It wasn't out before the Emmys, so no one knows what its awards hopes are yet until it does or doesn't get nominated for things. But Alison Brie is totally the kind of actress who the Globes love to coronate, even though obviously for fans of Community and indie movies and all manner and Mad Men and all manner of things, really,
yeah,
we don't need to be introduced to Alison Brie. We know her. We know her quite well.
Yeah.
But still, she's never been nominated for Emmys for these things. So let's see if maybe she can get a nod. And yeah, the ensemble is so great that I would love for that to get a SAG ensemble comedy nomination.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, so incredibly strong year for TV actresses. And do you see next year this getting to being an even bigger trend?
It feels like it is. It feels definitely like if you compare this year and last year to 5 years ago, where often there were really random things that would get nominated for awards and you just wouldn't understand it. I led this piece by mentioning that somehow Piper Perabo was a Golden Globe nominee for Covert Affairs a few years ago. Kelly Thorne from Necessary Roughness. And if anyone even remembers what that was, good for you. She was a Golden Globe nominee. There were a lot of years where the Globes would nominate truly random things. I mean, this is the group that loved Pia Zadora,
right?
And also the Globes do what they do, but there are just so many fantastic lead female performances in both drama and comedy and movie miniseries that it's my assumption that this is gonna, hopefully knock on wood, continue, because honestly this is where the great roles are, and so hopefully people will keep writing them, and hopefully more and more women will be given the opportunities to run shows and to direct shows, and that only makes it more possible for there to be strong female performances.
Is there anything down the pike that you are looking forward to?
There are a bunch of things that have come out very recently that could come into play if awards voters have the chance to actually see them. I think that DeWanda Wise is great in Netflix's She's Gotta Have It. I think that's a really great comedy lead performance. I would like to see someone give her a little recognition. I think that Rachel Brosnahan in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, that is a great lead performance.
And now I was going to segue into that one after we finish with that.
Excellent. Well, Steve, this is I'm anticipating your segue. So yeah, so that is the kind of performance that I would love to see get some recognition, because it's a show that is new, and it's tough to cut through the clutter at the end of the year, and Amazon premiered it at a slightly strange time. I think a lot of people thought when they saw the premiere date that it was going to be the same Thanksgiving premiere as Gilmore Girls last year, and then it turned out it was just randomly the week after, and that was odd. I don't quite get that, but yeah, I would love to see her get some recognition for that show.
Tell everybody about the show. I haven't started watching it yet, but I plan on watching it because it looks just great. And you know, I saw the trailer for it. You talked about it a few months back, and obviously Amy Sherman Palladino, you know, she created Gilmore Girls, one of my favorite shows. But tell everybody, it's such a great premise, and boy, does it look good. I mean, just from the trailer, like production design, costumes, oh my God.
Yeah, it is Mad Men-esque in the level of costume and production design. It's just beautiful. It is, as you say, it's Amy Sherman Palladino, and also a little bit Daniel Palladino as well, her husband. And it's set in 1958 Manhattan, and it's the story of a upper class, or maybe upper middle class, but really probably fairly wealthy Jewish housewife whose husband turns out to be a bit of a putz, and in her frustration, she finds herself drunk and on stage at a Greenwich Village nightclub, and doing stand up. And it turns out that she's brilliant. And among the people she meets in her first night on stage is a young Mr. Lenny Bruce. So the subsequent episodes, I've seen the first four episodes, and I meant to watch more this week, and just there's a lot of TV. It's Amy Sherman Palladino writing. It's a very specific time period. She has a very good sense of the conversational rhythms of the time, of the references of the time. It just feels very right. And again, Rachel Brosnahan, who people would know from, let's see, maybe they'd know her from WGN America's Manhattan. They would probably know her from House of Cards. She's been moving her way up into more and more visible things. This is totally a breakout role for her. She is funny. She is spirited, and she just really holds the screen and delivers the Amy Sherman Palladino dialogue wonderfully. And I think the show has sort of wanders in focus at times in what I've seen, but the lead performance is just so good, and it's just such a pleasure to listen to people talking like Amy Sherman Palladino people talk that it's worth it for that.
Yeah, and Tony Shalhoub is in it too, who's just, you know, fantastic. So
it is a very good cast. Alex Borstein, who everyone will know as a vocal star, Family Guy, and all of that. She has a past with Amy Sherman Palladino, but she has a very key supporting role, and it's I would say the best live action work that she's ever done. And then just a wide assortment of great character actors. A couple Amy Sherman Palladino favorites pop up. One of the Bunheads, for example, is in a key supporting role, etc. Yeah, it's just a well-populated universe. It's a universe with a lot of possibilities for storytelling, and it's not exactly like anything that you've seen before, even if you are tired of TV shows about how hard it is to be a stand-up comedian, because heaven knows there are enough of those shows.
Yeah.
This is just different enough that you don't feel like, oh God, it's another one of those.
Right. 11 episodes total?
Is that how many it is?
Yeah,
I'm not 100% sure, but it was picked up initially for two seasons when it was ordered. It was one of those Amazon pilot season things. Why it didn't just get a series order, I have no idea, but they did give it two seasons up front, so you don't need to worry. It'll go on for a little while. It won't be abruptly canceled like Amazon's Good Girl Revolt, so there's that. I really enjoyed it, and if there weren't so many things on my plate at the end of the year, I definitely would have watched a few more episodes after it premiered this week, so yeah.
Just looking at it, it is 11 episodes, and it is streaming now on Amazon Prime, so give that a look. All right, cool. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right. Dan Feinberg is with us for his biweekly visit, and he is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Much more TV to talk about right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We get to get back to our conversation. Dan Feinberg is my guest. He joins me every other week. TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back. Dan, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Let's talk about the problem with Apu, which I just loved. This is a true TV documentary. Tell everybody about it.
It is self-explanatory in the sense that there's a problem with Apu, even if you love him and he's one of your favorite characters from The Simpsons. I think that, you know, a solid 27 years after the show premiered, most right-thinking people can take a step back and realize that it's a little bit odd for a white guy to be doing an outsized Indian accent as one of the key characters on this show. And so, yeah, so Hari Kondabalu, who's a stand-up comic. And
very funny. And very, very funny. Yes. Yeah.
Very funny. He wrote and produced and appears in this documentary that aired on True TV. He did not direct it, but he is sort of the focal feature of it. And it's basically him walking himself through this feeling of ambivalence and being torn between a TV show that you love, a TV show in which so many memories and characters and lines and images are sort of a part of your being, a part of your comic DNA, and having at the center of the show this character who is backward and from a different generation of representation. And so he goes through basically how it impacts you if you're a young person and you go back to 1989, 1990, and Apu is the only Indian character represented on TV, or one of one or two or three, and how that makes you feel and how that makes people react to you and how that makes people react to your parents and their journey as immigrants and the pain that that can cause when a show that you otherwise love has this thing that causes you genuine irritation at best and really messes with the way people around the world view you. And it makes its point very well. He brings in many, many, many of his friends to agree with many, many, many of his points of view. And so the people who are in this, it's just an amazing group of talking heads, ranging from Aziz Ansari to Hasan Minhaj, Asif Mandavi. It's a great, great group of people who, you know, come to many similar opinions to his. You know, Cal Penn says straight up that he can't watch The Simpsons at all because of this.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite moments. Yeah. And it was one of my favorite moments in the documentary was that. And Hari was completely taken aback by that when Cal Penn said that. He's like, wait, what? Cal Penn made some really great points, you know?
He did, and it's interesting. One of the most interesting things about that is Cal Penn then also similarly justifying his work in Van Wilder, justifying how he came to be a character named Taj Mahal,
right?
Van Wilder,
right?
But also then going into how Harold and Kumar, how that's a different kind of representation, and how, you know, there's a pride that he can take in that kind of representation because it's not Apu. And it's a lot of people having very interesting reactions. My sort of reservation on the documentary is that it's kind of half of a documentary. It's 49 minutes.
Yeah.
And for very logical reasons, the Simpsons did not send out an assortment of writers, producers, and Hank Azaria to be talking heads in this
right
documentary.
Well, one of the subplots, though, is the contact that Hari was making with Hank Azaria, you know, reaching out to him and getting that email back. And when they read the email, it's like, what? And that was like, it was kind of like the, you know, it was a little bit of Roger and Me-ish. Like him trying to, in a much more subtle way than Roger and Me, but him trying to sort of track down Hank Azaria. And that becomes part of the thread of the show.
It does. And, you know, I wish that there was more that they were able to do with that. And, of course, the limitations are the people who would sit down and talk about this. And you can't force people to be there. So Dana Gould, who's a comic and has written on many things and wrote on The Simpsons for, you know, a good chunk of time in one of kind of the golden ages of the show. Yeah. He's there to be the representative of the show to some degree. And his answers are awful. I mean, he's just dreadful, and it's not his fault. I don't think he's trying to be offensive. He just gives these very pat comedy answers, like we have to be able to make fun of everybody whatever. And he tries challenging Hari on what the difference is between Apu and Mr. Burns, and Hari just tears him to shreds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so clear. And you want Dana Gould at the end to go, okay, well, yes, you're right. And there's nothing I can do but give this, you know, half-hearted answer as an alternative. But yeah, so the whole point is there's a problem with Apu, and then the question comes at the end, well, okay, so now what? And I wish there was a little bit more on the, okay, now what can we do?
I had a great time watching it, and I really thought it was great. All right, Dan, hang on.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us. We got to take a break for the news, and afterwards, more TV talk with Dan Feinberg. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we shall take a break right now for the news. Welcome back, everyone. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about brand loyalty, give you a little preview of all the new stuff coming up on Netflix in December, and we're going to have another edition of Pop-Up Video. Skip Skipley's in the jet on the way. 312-981-7200 is the phone number right here on WGN. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has your opening bell at 5, and then Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Every couple of weeks, we talk to Dan Feinberg, who is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N, and let's get back to the TV conversation with Dan. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about a show that I had a difficult time getting through for season one. The season two is starting, and I'm really intrigued again because the talent behind it and the people that are in it, but I so actively dislike the characters. I'm talking about Search Party. But I know that they're going down an even darker avenue in the second season. Tell everybody about this. Michael Showalter was on Seth Meyers the other night talking about this. And, of course, because I love Michael Showalter, I was like, well, maybe I got to give this thing another chance. So
I don't know what to tell you, except that if you did not like the characters on Search Party in the first season, you are not going to like them anymore this season, because as bad as the things that they found themselves doing in the first season, where things left off at the end of the first season had them doing the worst thing imaginable.
Right.
And so the second season finds these characters basically dealing with the cover-up of a murder.
Right.
And let's just say that's not the kind of thing that brings out the best in any of them.
Right.
And this is absolutely a show about a group of the worst, most unlikable people on television. And part of the challenge of the show is finding yourself recognizing certain aspects of yourself probably in these characters, and either you want to admit it or you don't. I am, you know, satisfied to admit that there are definitely things I see of myself in these characters. I can't deny it. And the thing I can't deny is the idea that placed in circumstances of this nature, I would probably be in some ways just as awful and maybe not quite as funny. And it is a a great cast, led by Alia Shawkat, who's everyone loves from Arrested Development, and is just great here. It's a fantastic performance, and the illusion of the first season was that her character might have been a good person in this sea of awful people, and by the end of the first season, it was pretty clear that she's not. And so a lot of the second season is, at least in the early going, these characters still holding on to a vestige of a belief that they're good people, even though everyone knows they're not.
Yeah.
And the supporting performances are all just great. John Early, who has popped up in certain things, including Wet Hot American Summer, is spectacular. Meredith Hagner is great. Brandon Michael Hall, who's the star of The Mayor now on ABC, his supporting part for the first season has been bumped up a little bit. I don't know that I've found these six episodes of the second season that I've seen so far to be quite as good as the first season, but close enough given what a hard thing this show is trying to accomplish.
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm going to go back and rewatch the first season and because I made it much further into Search Party than I did Friends from College. That I found those characters to be, I couldn't, and I loved everybody in Friends from College, but I found those characters to be just despicable, and I hated them. I actually liked the characters in Search Party more. So, the people that are in this show, the people that are behind this show, are all people that I respect and really like a lot, so I'm going to go back and give it a second chance.
I think that the difference between Search Party and Friends from College is that I think that Friends from College really thinks that some of its characters are charming and likable, and I'm pretty sure that Search Party knows better.
Right.
And so I think that probably there's a clarity of vision that Search Party has that Friends from College lacked, and that's why I find Search Party so much a more effective and frequently and almost always funnier. I mean, it's just a funny show.
Yeah.
It's very true to what it is. The first season was a complicated, interestingly spun mystery story, and it was truly mysterious. And the second season is a suspense piece about people who do an awful thing and worry about getting caught and, you know, the cover-up being worse than the crime and all of that. And it's a good version of one of those stories in which the characters are awful people who are therefore funny. But it's true to the genre while also being funny and cringy.
Yeah. Okay. Search Party Season 2, it's on TBS. And there you go. Hey, you interviewed David Lynch.
I did indeed. It was a complicated process. The short version of the interview that ran in the Hollywood Reporter and the magazine does not capture the kind of push and pull of the conversation. I hope that the longer version that went up online does capture some of the trying to get answers out of a man who would just as soon not explain himself and yet was still nice enough to talk to me for 20 minutes and was utterly charming and amiable in doing so and in telling me almost nothing. And it was a pleasure to attempt to parry and to feel as if I was pretty much losing every step of the way, because it's one of those things where, because he doesn't want to give answers, you could spend a full 20 minutes trying to rephrase your first question 15 different ways, and then you could get to the end and realize, oh God, I asked absolutely nothing that I wanted to. I feel like I probably went down a couple too many holes of trying to rephrase myself and lost 5 to 10 minutes, but I think that's the game. And, you know, it was terrifying chatting with him for that reason.
Sure.
Because he's David Lynch.
Yeah.
But again, such a nice and smart man, and in certain moments, totally willing to talk about things, and in other moments, totally unwilling, but not in any way mean or hostile about it, and I appreciate that.
Did you mention episode 8? Was that discussed at all?
I'm trying to think if we even touched on it. I think I touched on it briefly, just in the sense of how do people from Showtime respond when you bring in these episodes.
Right.
But he just didn't have much to say other than they let him do what he wanted to do, and that's pretty obvious to anyone who watched these 18 episodes is what David Lynch wanted to do. Yeah. He got to do.
And what avenues were you going down that you wanted to get answers? Did you get any answers at all?
Like little bits here and there. I think he had sort of thoughtful things to say about kind of the sadness of being in the editing room and realizing as he was going through these last moments that he caught with the many cast members who passed on either immediately during production or even afterwards, you know, thinking back now on Harry Dean Stanton, for example. Yeah. And he did get kind of reflective about that. He got reflective about the challenges of directing all 18 episodes and just how there was no opportunity to stop and no opportunity to look back. You just had to keep doing it. And he sounds like he enjoys doing television, but also he doesn't sound like he's pitching pilots to five networks this spring in the hopes that he'll, you know, become the next Greg Berlanti and have 11 TV shows on the air next year. It doesn't sound like he's going to go down that road, but it sounds like he enjoyed the experience on this and like he's not saying that he isn't going to go back to it. I don't know that I need him to attempt to explain where things ended at the end of this season. I don't know what good answers would do, and I don't know why anyone would think that if he came back to Twin Peaks, he'd give them answers.
Yeah.
So
I would rather not have answers, quite frankly. That's one of the things I love about the show. It's the genuine complete confusion that I felt after every single episode.
And I don't think you need to worry. I think that if he said he was coming back, everyone would be like, oh, yes, we're finally going to get answers to dot, 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 dot. Then they'd get to the end of the first episode of the new season. They'd be like, wait, that was none of the things I thought I wanted. What the heck?
Right.
So
yeah.
Bring it on, actually.
Yeah, people were thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to finally find out what's going on. And no, you didn't. It got a little complicated. It got complicated. I had the same response kind of. To a lesser extent, to Blade Runner 2049, when the ultimate question about whether Deckard is a replicant or not, you know, we're finally going to get that answer. No, we didn't. And that's fine with me. So,
I would not. There's nothing I would want answers to. And I also don't think I don't think that David Lynch is predisposed or capable of giving straightforward answers. So yeah. I would not worry that we will ever get over answered on Twin Peaks.
Better things wrapped up. Unbelievable season. Just unbelievable season. Now, on just this question that I have is FX is still advertising Baskets. And so I'm assuming Baskets and Better Things are still alive.
It's going to be interesting to see. Baskets was in the can. It's what it is. I think at this point, I think they're done with the third season. And as you say, they haven't pulled advertisement. Though my understanding is that
by way of explanation, really quickly, Louis C.K. is an executive producer on both of those shows, and FX has severed ties with Louis C.K. So I'm sorry people who might not have known that.
Thank you for clarifying that. So I think that probably Baskets will premiere without Pig Newton, which is Louis C.K.'s production banner, without that attached at all, and I think that will be relatively okay. I mean, that's a show that really and truly was Jonathan Kreisel's baby.
Right.
So the writer director who basically steered the show is still there, and it's not Louis C.K. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with Better Things because Louis C.K.'s involvement on that show is not incidental.
No,
it's not like he's just a guy whose name is on it. The writer or co-writer of every episode.
Right.
I assume they're not going to bring it back under those auspices. It's not going to come back with him writing or co-writing every episode officially. So I think they will give Pamela Adlon legitimately as much time as she wants to say, I can do this. I feel comfortable. I directed every one of these episodes. This is my story. This is my thing. I can do it. Yeah. Or to say, I don't want to do it. I can't do it anymore. And I don't.
It's just, it's a damn shame because this, I mean, first of all, Better Things is a great show, and this last season was unbelievable with a beautiful finale. I mean, just beautiful. And I really hope it has a life. I really do, man.
So. And the thing is, the finale is, you know, obviously was made so long before any of this became official, but the whole theme of the finale is, sometimes men are going to let you down.
Exactly.
And men are going to abandon you and betray you. And if you can't count on them, here's how you go through. Here's how you keep on living.
Yeah.
Here's how you keep dancing. Here's how you keep being a family when men let you down.
Yeah.
Which is beautiful both in general and in specific.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting to see if, in end of the year top 10 lists, if some people feel the need to penalize the show because of Louis C.K.'s involvement. And I, you know, it's not for me to say what anyone else is supposed to do. I don't think personally I'm going to be able to penalize Pamela Adlon's achievement on this show because it's so great.
Yeah.
And she deserves so much credit. I don't want to take the credit away from her.
I agree, man. I totally agree. It's just a damn shame and a mess. We're out of time, Dan, but I wanted to take this opportunity at the end here to thank you one more time for turning me on to The Rundown with Robin Thede. That's all I want to say. I want to thank you. That show is terrific.
I hope we turn 5 or 10 other people on.
Thursday nights at 10 on BET. Fantastic. It's called The Rundown. Make sure you watch it. Dan, always a pleasure, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Nick.
Okay, take care. Dan Feinberg, everybody. Hollywood reporter. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN, The Fine Print. All right, we'll take a break here.